It sounds like an anti-erection medicine.
Actually, that's, you'll find that with a lot of the cities around here, they could be medication names like, you know, suffering from toenail fungus. Try Centralia or try Forks or whatever it might be.
Forks.
Yeah. That's where the Twilight films are set, right?
Absolutely, but they shot about 30 seconds of them actually in Forks.
Oh, so, try Centralia.
Try Centralia. Or
Centralia may cause cancer.
Can't pick up your food? Try Forks.
Right. Exactly. So we're talking.
That,
take that. We're talking The World's End with Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, and Edgar Wright. Simon, you and Edgar wrote this. Nick, you got to be a part of this as well. Yeah. And I would imagine on set, you know, the two of you are the creative minds behind this. But I'm kind of curious right off the bat. A lot of the humor that seems to come from this seems to come from, like, you're shooting from the hip. Is this from script to screen? How much are you writing, and how much are you guys just kind of, I guess, sparring with on set there?
It's all written.
It's all written, actually. I mean, what we tend to do, which kind of flies in the face of a lot of contemporary comedies, is we do write the screenplay, and it's, you know, if you read the first draft of the script, you'd find it's extremely close to the finished product. But what we do is, like, rehearse the movie, and there, that's where Mr. Frost, like, sprinkles his magic fairy dust on the movie. But I think also the reason that a lot of people ask us about that, and I think that's a credit to the actors' performances, that they make it feel really naturalistic, and that it is actually just like sort of freewheeling, you know. But in reality, the screenplay is very precise, you know.
Mm-hmm. With a number of sort of the British comedies, often I see or hear that I would imagine that it is fairly well rehearsed, but one of the things I always really appreciate is the ability to kind of just rattle off your lines so rapid fire that the dialogue just hits you almost kind of just with this nonstop barrage, and each line gets funnier than the next. And I see that a lot in this film as well, particularly some of the lines that Gary ends up delivering when you just kind of get going on a tear. And I have to kind of go, whoa, stop, wait, I got to hear that, what was that again? So I have to watch this again now to...
That's good.
That's Gary's technique, that's Gary's MO, you know. He kind of like, he sweeps people along in a sort of whirlwind of manipulation, and basically the guys come along with him to Newton Haven, to the pub crawl, because it's almost too much effort not to, you know. He kind of like has this patter which is so calculated and so almost so rehearsed that he very quickly gets them to fall back into their old sort of types, you know, that they feel they've outgrown a long, long time ago. And within 40 minutes of them starting drinking, they're already like they used to be when they were kids, you know. And that feeds into their, when things start to go crazy, you know, that's why the guys carry on following Gary, despite the fact that it's the stupidest thing to do.
Also, I think it goes, again, down to the performance, too, in terms of keeping it naturalistic, is you rattle it out, you know. That's, I think it's very rare that people kind of very slowly talk their work, you know, so people can hear. I think you just have to, you know, if you're doing a scene which is full of emotion, and that's how it is. That's how you got to do it, you know.
Right. The irony is as well, I know you said it, you hear it in a lot of British comedy, but when on set, if we would do a take and I wanted them to go faster, I would say, now let's do it in Marx Brothers speed. That's why that would be my like direction.
Yeah.
Like, let's do a Marx Brothers take. Because, you know, when I watch a lot of those like old comedies, they go fast.
Super
His Girl Friday, like Duck Soup, it's like rat-a-tat, you know.
Yeah. So who initially came up with the germ of the idea for, you know, five guys going back to Newton Haven, between the two of you writing, who was this?
Well, there was a couple of things that were like a seed for the movie. Was I had gone on a pub crawl when I was 19, and it had been a very disastrous, like, silly night. And but it is always like sort of stuck with me. And I'd even written a script about it when I was in my early 20s that I never made. But that was about teenagers on a pub crawl. And then way, way later, whilst we were on the Hot Fuzz press tour, it hit me that maybe that might be more interesting and richer if it was about older guys trying to recreate former glories. And that was also because... And then on top of that, it was also this feeling about doing something about returning to your hometown and that bittersweet experience. And when we had made Hot Fuzz... I had returned to my hometown to make it, so I'd had that experience very vividly. So, but then I told Simon about it whilst we were like doing the press tour for Hot Fuzz, and very quickly the whole story, including the sci-fi element, fell in almost immediately.
Yeah, I mean, the sci-fi element as well was very broad when we first discussed it, you know, because we had this... The idea I remember in its being in its very infancy was going back to your hometown, being weirded out because it all felt very different, and then rather than that being because you changed and because of what the, you know, you always feel alienated when you go back to your hometown because you have changed, that there is a very real reason for that, and it's, you know, that everyone has changed, literally.
Right.
And then when we started to discuss years later, when we got together to sit down for our first writing meeting, then the nature of the enemy took place, took shape, and we came up with this idea that would enable us to... you know, to fashion the film that you see now. And that happened over a weekend, really. But the big idea, the big sort of concept for the movie happened very quickly and sat and percolated for a very long time.
And then took off from there. Cool. So as far as, like, the characters that were all then created or came up about this, did you have models already or people that you knew in your lives who were Garys or so, you know, I mean...
Yeah, I think everyone has a Gary King in their life, and we, you know, we've been saying that if you don't know a Gary King, you should look at yourself in the mirror. you could have Gary King.
You could be the Gary.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have two Gary Kings in my life at the moment, and they're still current friends, so I can't really talk much about them.
Okay.
But one of them has a big blackhead in his ear. It's horrible. I can't stop looking at it, so I don't see him anymore because I can't stop looking at it.
You want to squeeze it?
Yeah.
You should get him to get it squeezed.
No,
you feel like you can.
I want to do it.
You want to do it yourself?
Yeah.
I think you end up like basing, you know, when you write characters, of course you write about what you know, and so characters become amalgams of lots of different people you know and yourselves. I think sort of me and Simon, you know, and Nick would probably see a little bit of ourselves in all of the characters, including Gary. I think that's when you start to sort of like, you know, sometimes you start to imagine sort of like, you know, characters as yourself if you'd gone down a different path. And I think sort of like, you know, Gary is one of those characters that were, he is like challenging and sort of deeply kind of flawed, but I think we have a lot of sympathy for him, but we want him to find some way to get redemption or triumph, like from rock bottom, you know.
And who's the actual fan of Sisters of Mercy here?
Me.
This guy.
Okay. Okay, so, and was that your own T-shirt, or was that...
I did have that T-shirt. Okay. I had exactly that T-shirt. I cut the sleeves off. It was like a vest, and I had it, a tank top. I was a big goth when I was sort of 16 to 18, and the Sisters of Mercy were my favorite band. I'm talking about 85 Sisters of Mercy, the original lineup.
Right.
The track we use in the film is from the 87 incarnation, when he was joined by Patricia from the Gun Club. Wayne Hussey had left by that time. It's still brilliant, that song, though. I loved it, and the album Floodland is great, but First and Last and Always for me is the better album.
Right, okay. The historian
Sisters of Mercy bomb there.
So, and I'm imagining, because I was told before I came in here, don't ask how many beers did you have to drink on the film, and because I know you've already been asked that, and I'm not even going to ask it. I don't even want to know. I don't even.
I like that somebody asked.
Only because we didn't
say it.
Yeah. There's a buck coming,
but I do want to know. Metric system, it's the Golden Mile.
Yes.
I know there's the Royal Mile in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
We never adopted the metric system in terms of distance in the UK. It's always stayed miles. If you go into Europe, uh-huh. then it's kilometres. But
right.
even though we adopted the smaller increments like metres and centimetres, although to be honest, we're still talking feet and inches. We're a very dogged nation, the UK. We don't like change. We didn't really... I mean, it took us a long time to accept the decimal, you know, the get away from shillings and tuppence and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But we've never changed our signage to update to kilometres. So for us, it's still miles.
We're good on kilos, though.
The gold,
we're good on kilos?
You know,
yeah, I think
we like a pound, though.
No,
well, I measure myself in stones. I don't measure myself in pounds or kilos.
Here in Seattle, it's still clams.
I find it hard when I get on a running machine to put my weight in because I don't understand either kilograms or pounds. I don't understand either.
Right.
I'm 12 stone.
Golden kilo doesn't sound as cool, though, does it?
I don't know. I started kind of saying it to myself. I was like, no, it just doesn't hit my ear the same way. I like the golden mile better.
We're still fighting to keep those old measurements.
Golden 1.6 kilometers.
It just doesn't have the same ring to it.
No. You don't have like a half a meter of ale. It's a yard of ale.
And I wanted to ask, too, about small towns. What is it about small towns that you find particularly... I guess intriguing, because a lot of all the films that I've seen you guys in have all featured, you know, what appear to be these smaller towns, and you could go here anywhere in the States as well and find oddities about each of them, but in the same...
I think it's because we, you know...
It's
where we're from. Like, me and Simon both grew up in smaller towns. But Shaun of the Dead is set in London, where we, you know, all lived. And
but a small part of London, not the London you see.
The suburbs.
Not Red Bus London, you know, as we... Although I think there probably is a... It's a single-decker, isn't it, that's in Shaun of the Dead?
Yeah.
It's not like... You know, usually in an American movie, when you cut to the UK, you hear a little bit of Rule Britannia, and you see the Houses of Parliament, and a Red Bus goes by.
Yeah, 101 Dalmatian style.
That's not where we wanted to set the film.
Oh, yeah. Kids Big Ben, right.
Yeah, exactly. Meanwhile, in England...
There's a beefy
tale. Yeah. And Nick, for you, how about you? Where are you from originally?
I'm from a place called Dagenham in East London.
Okay.
Which is a bit of a shithole.
to put it frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I haven't really been back. I was quite glad to get out of there, to be honest.
You spent some time in Hampstead West, though, didn't you? Which is a small Welsh town.
Yeah, my family... Well, my mum was Welsh, so, you know, I spent a lot... Yeah, I mean, that's quite an odd place going back there. I remember going back to a pub that I used to drink in when I was 16, about 10 years later, and two of the same girls were still in there, but just... I think they'd lost a couple more teeth. So, yes, you know...
Something we almost see happen here in the world's end.
Yeah, the marmalade sandwich, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
The legendary marmalade sandwich. Wanted to ask,
did it make you hungry for a marmalade sandwich after the movie?
I was never really a marmalade fan, to be honest. I was more sort of like other preserves, but I'll you know, hey, you know,
Becky Salt.
We'll do jam on the next one.
You just have to dye her hair. You make it a jam, strawberry jam sandwich.
There you go.
We'll do Nutella in the next one.
Yes. Exotic. Actually, that'd be delicious. The so now here's the question. Also, I've been thinking about which is. There's this thing, there's an expression, or it's a term, it's called paraprodokianism. And it's where you have a phrase. Churchill was really familiar with these, used them a lot. You start with a phrase, and it ends with something that turns it on its ear, much the way a lot of your films do. And a way I see a lot of the humor in the film going, for instance, like, hurting you is the last thing I want to do, but it's still on my list. That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Are there common phrases that you guys turn to writing or as acting, or that are particularly you find signature to your style or to the UK, or
maybe not phrases, but certainly techniques. You know, we like to be, you know, we love irony, and we like to sort of make sure that we temper comedy with drama and drama with comedy, and you know, have things that resonate on multiple levels rather than just be jokes. You know, we like to have the jokes exist on top of a real story with real characters and have genuine jeopardy and genuine emotion underscoring the comedy and sometimes taking over from it, you know.
We like to have that rhythm as well. I think sort of a lot of the comedy has that rhythm where people are thinking fast enough that they've changed their mind mid-sentence. Like, a good example of that would be when Rosamund Pike challenges Gary about sleeping with some twins, and he says, A, no, I did not, and B, how did you know about that? like he's changed his mind.
And then he says, it was like there was four of them, I'm not proud of it, I am a bit.
Yeah, it's like constantly changing his mind at like every other second.
Right.
And that was a real gift with a character like Gary, who's like what we would say had a coke brain.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he literally cannot remember the start of his point. He's going to like argue with himself. Like, as he's talking, he'll just kind of adopt his kind of stance to oppose any argument.
Well, the whole selective memory thing is kind of, you know, that feeds into what Gary has, feeds into what the enemy has as well, and, you know, that kind of, the repetition of that phrase or that kind of concept comes back again and again.
Yeah. Now, in Andy's case, right, or Nick, your case, but Andy, your character... We often are hearing also, I want to ask a quick question because I see Kim heading over here.
Oh, no.
Do we ever see, or is there something left on the cutting room floor that explains a little more about the accident that happened between the two of you? Because we hear about it referenced, but I'm curious if there was...
He does explain it, though.
Yeah.
He does say, I mean, in the scene in the Bowls Club, he explains what happened. There isn't anything that we cut out, no.
Okay.
We never wanted it to be... It's not particularly important. The idea was that there was something that had happened, and it simply turns out that Andy drove Gary to hospital when he was... Because Gary had OD'd on heroin, and Andy rolled the car.
You know.
And then Gary ran off. That was it, you know. And that had been a turning point for Andy. But it was never really about that, you know. It was more... It was a deeper problem.
Right. And as far as what often gets left on the cutting room floor, there's a phrase we call killing your baby, where there's something that you really love about the film, and you shoot it, it's all there, it's ready to go, but you put the film together and you're like, nah, it just doesn't work, so you have to cut it out.
That happens more in the writing process.
Yeah, I think there are a couple. There's only a couple of things that we cut out. Like, what happens with those scenes usually with like a deleted scene is it's like an amputation. Is that once you've actually sort of done the chop, like you feel, oh, I feel a lot better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, so it's actually like, you know, there's one scene that we took out, and it's like, it was a funny scene in its own right, but it's like, as soon as it had gone, it's like, that's never going back in the film. So it's very, like, when you do, like, cuts and stuff, there's nothing that I've cut out of the movies that I've really regretted and stuff. I think maybe in Scott Pilgrim there was one line that I cut out that I wish I kept back in. But, like, other than that, like, there's nothing that I think, we should have kept that thing in, you know.
Plus, it's so, you know, the way it's written and shot, it's so interconnected and crafted, is that you couldn't take this out without it affecting everything else down the line, you know.
Yeah, yeah. On a complete non sequitur here, I see a note that says, big knockers. Right over your shoulder here.
Edgar writes things during phoners to try and make us laugh. Okay. We're doing a phone interview. This goes about years and years and years.
Also, I just bought a new house, so that's to remind me I need to buy some
big knockers
for the front door.
I found the best ones to be actually in England. Like, they have the best hardware.
We have great knockers.
Yeah,
England has great,
fantastic knockers.
We've actually bought in the next interview just to demonstrate to you the
five over.
The need
I'm
to
five
move
over.
On.
How do we get there? It only says 16.
This is your intervention.
That's because you know what? It's a special treat.
That's yours to keep.
I'll take a pass, but thank you.